This is XTP Media.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around.
Dear men from the planet Earth, first set foot upon the moon, July 1969, AD. It came in peace for all mankind.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, unité. Confirmé. Top, allumage EAP, décollage.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 9 of Extended. And a welcome to my co-hosts and aerospace experts, editor at Global Aviation Resource, Gareth Stringer.
Hello, everybody.
And editor of Aerospace International, Tim Robinson.
Hello there.
Now, in this episode, we've got a focus on space travel and exploration with interviews from Emma Lord at the UK Space Agency. And associated with this segment, we've got yet another competition with a prize from the UK Space Agency.
You know, I think there are still areas where there is a bit of a space race.
We also have Gene McCulker from Talking Space who joins us.
I actually was Surveyor 3 when the Apollo 12 astronauts brought back a piece of the Surveyor spacecraft. It was found that apparently a technician had sneezed on a component on the spacecraft, and those microbes apparently survive.
And Tim gets to speak to British astronaut Tim Peake.
An EVA is certainly a very, very physically and mentally demanding skill to have.
And finally, Gareth gets to talk to author of Moondust, Andrew Smith.
But even then, actually, the computer on the lunar module, which landed on the moon, had less power than far less than your mobile phone.
So, we also have the competition results from the last episode and some listener feedback in the Get Involved segment. As well as all of that, we've got a new segment called
Things You Never Knew About.
So, another extended episode with lots to talk about on a topic we haven't covered so far. Before we get too embroiled, I got interested in space when I was maybe 6 or 7, and I was an Apollo child. For me, space is all about its enormity and the technology that's being developed to explore it. But what I wanted to know from Gareth and Tim was how you got interested in space. Gareth?
For me, it started watching The Right Stuff, the movie of The Right Stuff, Tom Wolfe's seminal book, which starts with Chuck Yeager breaking the sound barrier, but largely discusses the very beginnings of the space race, the Mercury 7, and the quest and the race to put a man into orbit. That's where it all started for me. And this is rather bizarre. I can remember watching the film as probably about a 12-year-old, and my mum got it for me to watch when I was off school sick. And I sat on the sofa and watched The Right Stuff, and that's where it all started for me.
Right, okay. And what about you, Tim?
Bizarrely enough, I blame it on my dad. My dad got me into aerospace in the first place in plastic kits and balsa wood models and taking me to Shuttlesworth. But he also had a very fine collection of National Geographic magazines from the 60s.
Right.
And they were up the shed, and I used to flick through these, and they had the most amazing kind of cutaways and articles on, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo. where America was going, where the world was going, really, on this sort of new exciting new frontier. And I was just hooked on that. You know, it was just really sort of absolutely amazing.
Well, I think we get going with the show. We, as always, start with some news. And whilst we want to focus on space and aerospace, I think there's one subject we just can't avoid, and that's the troubles with the 787, Tim.
That's right. I mean, that's been the big news in the last couple of sort of week and a half, really, is the grounding of the Dreamliner. It's had
or the Nightmare Liner, I think somebody called it.
Some of the headlines are writing themselves. You know, Dreamliner turns into nightmare for Boeing, Flatliner, etc., etc. So the current status is the global Dreamliner fleet is grounded, and you know, after they had a couple of fires or smoke events. One was a fire on the ground, another one was a sort of a smoke event, and the aircraft turned back, landed safely. The FAA has taken the decision to ground them. There's a joint investigation with Boeing, and the national sort of aviation authorities, like in Japan, have also sort of followed suit. They're still trying to get to the bottom of this. There's obviously something more deeper than, you know, have you overcharged the batteries? You know, Boeing was always pushing the technological, the boundaries of innovation with the 787.
Yeah.
They've also outsourced it, a lot of it. So the question is, you know, is there something deeper, or is it something that's just sort of teething troubles? However, let's get this in perspective. Previously, aircraft have crashed and people have been killed, and then you'll find there's been an investigation, new standards have been brought in, new technology has been brought in, all the way from the Comet, you know, kind of onwards, and air travel has progressively got safer. You know, 2012 was the most safest year ever since the dawn of the jet age.
Yeah.
So a fire, and obviously this is serious, something that people are taking very, very seriously, but it's actually proactive, and the regulatory authorities, the airlines, the Boeing, it's embarrassing, it's going to be expensive, but they're all working together and, you know, doing it before there is a fatal accident. It really is sort of embarrassing, but better do it now,
yeah,
than have a fatal accident.
I think another point that was made by my colleagues on the Airplane Geeks, Rob Mark was on CNN International yesterday, actually, on the TV. He was making the point the other day about, if you've seen the pictures of the battery, which I think most of us have, it's quite shocking. But that aircraft landed safely, even though there was obviously something catastrophic going on in the back. So it's another sign of how well aircraft design is now, and manufacture is, to accommodate a fire as severe as that.
And lithium, you know, the lithium iron batteries. I mean, you know, there have been some sort of questions raised about, well, you know, do you want to use them for aviation applications, etc., etc.
Yeah.
And you know, we all use them in our iPads and our iPhones, yeah, and our mobile phones and our laptops. We'd all be carrying our fire extinguishers around with us. You know, the instances of them actually going wrong are so low,
yeah,
insignificant now, that you know, who now thinks, you know, when they pick up the mobile phone, oh, you know, I'm carrying a potentially you know, kind of flammable device that could explode at any moment.
Well, we wish Boeing success in sorting that problem out. It's a lovely aircraft and we want to see it back flying. Let's get back then to other items of news. Gareth, anything caught your eye? I don't suppose you've managed a rocket ride yet.
No, but it is the childhood dream, isn't it? It absolutely is.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention something that happened fairly recently here in the UK, which was the tragic helicopter crash in London. I don't know if anybody listening, you know, has read the initial the bulletin that's been put out by the Air Accident Investigation Board, but I think, you know, you, just reading that, there's going to be lessons learned, and I think it just goes to show massively experienced pilot, poor weather, difficult conditions and such like. You know, I'm not certainly not speculating on any final outcomes, but you know, it's a difficult old job to do if you're single man or woman in a helicopter like that in those conditions. And thank goodness it wasn't worse than it was, despite the loss of life. That could have been an absolutely horrific accident, and almost sorry to mention it, but it's something that's just stuck in the mind from the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it really was a big week for aviation news. But there's one thing I'd like to say about that is that one of the things that the media coverage of that incident was, as well as sort of various people popping out and saying, "Oh, we shouldn't allow helicopters over London," there was kind of a bit of an inaccurate reporting there that pilot was a chauffeur to the the rich and famous, and sort of a taxi service. And actually, you looked at his background and what he actually did, and he was actually done a lot of air ambulance work.
Yeah.
Saving lives over London.
Yeah.
So, on the majority of helicopters over London, they're either, air ambulance or law enforcement.
Well, talking about the risks associated with flying in dangerous conditions, particularly flying helicopters, later this year, we will actually be talking to a pilot, a captain who flies North Sea helicopters. So that's something to look forward to, and we'll seek his views on how difficult and how challenging that can be. A story that caught my eye, bringing us a little bit back to the theme of the show, was on space.com. Europe tackling big space projects in 2013. The launch of its latest robot cargo ship, Albert Einstein, and the development of new rockets and spacecraft, including the reusable space plane, work on NASA's new Orion capsule, were all stories that were popular recently on space.com. And also on the Aero Society's website, there is a very interesting summary of the highlights of space in 2013. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes, but some really good stuff there. Now we're going to hear from Emma Lord shortly from the UK Space Agency about the UK and ESA. But this really is exciting times for the UK space sector, isn't it, Tim?
It certainly is. I mean, one of the things that sort of people have always sort of said is about the UK space sector, it's kind of a best kept secret of how good we are at this sort of particular niche that we've got. For example, small satellites, Surrey Satellites Limited, SSTL, and be a world leader in these nano satellites. And it's almost something that that we got, I wouldn't say kind of forced into, but the budget dictated. We haven't got the budget of NASA, we haven't got the budget of the US. So it's been a sort of like a concentration on what can we do. And one of the things we found we could do was these small satellites. And now you find that, well, actually, they're in a lot of demand. People want them because they're low cost, and the technology is now sort of kind of shrunk. Your mobile phone camera is a good example of that, smartphones. And now you've got people like the kind of U.S. Air Force or the U.S. who are interested in sort of nanosats, CubeSats. There was an announcement about sort of just last week about a company that wants to go and sort of mine asteroids by using, again, small, really low cost, sort of nanosats, small sats to go and find asteroids to kind of mine.
Let's hear what Emma Lord has to say. A few weeks ago, I got the privilege of getting a little bit of time with Emma, and she's the Director of Policy and Operations for the UK Space Agency. I'm in Swindon, in an office that a few years ago I didn't know existed, and with an organisation a few years ago I didn't know existed, the UK Space Agency. And today I'm with Emma Lord, Director of Policy and Operations at the UK Space Agency. Emma, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming to visit us in not-so-sunny Swindon.
Well, thanks for having us. The UK Space Agency, can you tell us a little bit about it and what its role is and how it came about?
Certainly. Of course, part of the clue is in the title. It is the UK Space Agency. So the agency looks after the civil space programme for the UK, which is actually quite a large space programme covering all sorts of things from telecommunications to Earth observation. Now, the UK has had a space programme. This year it celebrated the 50th anniversary of the launch of its first satellite. Before the agency came into being, there was a partnership group called the British National Space Centre that looked after the civil space programme for the UK.
Right.
But over recent years, people have thought perhaps we needed something a little bit more focused, a single point for the budgets and the management of the programme. Hence, eventually, we ended up establishing the UK Space Agency, and here we are.
Right. And how old is the UK Space Agency?
Well, this is something you may find different answers to. It actually became an executive agency on the 1st of April in 2011, but for a year before that, it was running as what's called a shadow agency, which is really a sort of bit of government speak there, to set up everything, so the finance, the legal side of things, the parliamentary side of things, so that on the 1st of April 2011, we'd got all the budgets lined up and we were ready to go.
So you're supported by government. Let's go back and look a little bit at the UK space industry then. 50 years old. On my research, I found that Ariel 1 was our first satellite, our first exploration into space. Can you just give us a little look back over the UK space industry just to tell us how it's evolved into what we've got now?
Well, since Ariel, the space industry has come on in leaps and bounds in the UK. As with many things, a lot of this is bound by resources. You know, what resources do we have? And I think this is a personal opinion, is that because of the geographical formation of the UK being an island, traditionally we've had to come up with our own solutions to things. And this applies across all technology, but especially in space, where researchers have had to innovate to develop everything from very small systems to very large satellite systems. And over the years, this has developed so that we are actually now a world leader in small satellite systems.
Right.
There's a company, Surrey Satellite Technology Limited, based in Surrey, as the title would suggest, which is the world leader in these sort of systems. Now, this is where our focus has been, on the sort of the technological innovation. And your listeners will appreciate that we don't have a manned space program. But again, a lot of this comes down to resource and what are we good at?
Yeah.
You know, we have limited resources. Let's put those into things that we're good at. But we do have an astronaut in training with the European Space Agency, and we have just put some money into the International Space Station as well. So I think we're sort of broadening, and we're lucky at the moment. We've got a supportive space minister.
Yeah.
Very enthusiastic about space and is really keen to see the industry continue to grow.
Depending on how you look at it and some of the ways that the numbers are calculated, I believe that we're second only to the USA in terms of our aerospace or our science-focused industries.
That figure is sometimes quoted in relation to the citations. So the number of citations of British science papers, second only to the USA. In terms of actually putting money into the European Space Agency, is where we do most of our business. We are the third largest contributor now. We've gone up the table slightly from fourth position following the recent ministerial meeting. So, yeah, we do have, on both fronts, we've got a lot of innovation and a lot of research on the one side, but we also have a lot of people actually building the technology on the other side.
Yeah. Okay, so let's look then at some of the research and development. Does the UK Space Agency fund or support that, or is it regulatory? How does that work?
Well, a lot of research is done at universities, obviously UK universities, and funded through the universities. We certainly support and encourage research. We don't actually put huge amounts of money into it because we ourselves have a limited budget. Most of our budget, probably around 80%, goes directly into the European Space Agency, into collaborative programs with the other 19 member states.
And the government's recently announced an increase in investment in the UK space industry. Can you tell us a little bit about where that's going to go?
Yeah, this is the investment came to about £1.2 billion across the next 5 years. Mm. And this will go into areas where the UK is strong, where Europe is strong. We've got big collaborative programs in areas such as telecommunications, Earth observation to monitor climate change, navigational systems as well.
Right.
And some of the work is around humanitarian relief as well. So again, that's Earth observation, but it's actually monitoring when there are natural disasters, getting satellites into the right places to look at what's going on so they can actually direct people on the ground. Yeah.
So let's talk about the link with the European Space Agency. You spend a lot of your time working with them. What programs are we supporting at the moment?
Well, at the moment, we support a large space science program. We've got about 320 million of the 1.2 billion is going into the space science program. We support a large telecommunications program and various Earth observation programs. Like I mentioned, there's the humanitarian relief aspect, and there's also the climate monitoring aspect. We've just put some money into the International Space Station as well, which is likely to go towards working with NASA through the European Space Agency, but towards a vehicle that will actually take people to the International Space Station in due course.
Yeah.
A lot of the space science is about understanding the universe better. Where did it originate? What's it growing into? The sort of great big questions that you really would like answers to, but nobody quite knows.
I can remember reading as a youngster books on the universe and that having that dichotomy of what's out there. There are probes, there are satellites off to places like Mars at the moment. Obviously, we've got the Curiosity probe that's got a lot of publicity at the moment. How's the UK space industry supporting those exploratory types of projects?
Well, a lot of it, again, comes down to the sort of innovative technology that the UK can come up with. So that might range from things like infrared cameras through to satellite batteries, through to actually having researchers here on the ground, so to speak, actually monitoring the results that are coming back and analysing them, interpreting them.
Yeah.
So it's quite a wide-ranging support, and we do have a really strong research base in the UK actually sort of looking at this information, because obviously you get the details back, you get lots of pretty pictures back, but you do need people to interpret that and to understand and explain what's going on, both to other scientists and to the general public, you know, like ourselves, really, in fairly sort of basic language, if you like. Why is this important? What are we seeing here?
Mm. And so some of the programs that are operating at the moment are broadening our aspects and our views of space. How's the UK Space Agency supporting, I suppose, the educational establishment in the UK?
Well, a lot of what we do is through social media, through our website, that sort of outreach to try to encourage people to get more traffic to the website, to explain to children some of the basic elements of the solar system and beyond and the sort of missions that we're involved in. We do as much outreach work as we can. We'd love to do more. We get out to schools to visit children, to visit voluntary groups such as the Girl Guides, the Scouting Organisation, just to talk to children about space, about what the UK does in space, and about the sort of avenues that might be available to them to get into the space industry in due course. It's a captive audience. You know, most people are fascinated by space. And we also have our Space UK magazine, which goes out to all the schools and is free to subscribe to if people want to.
Right.
So we do try to do a lot, and there's a lot more that we'd love to do as well.
Yeah.
And we're not the only organisation. There are various voluntary groups. Industry actually does a lot of work as well with school-age children and then onwards offering apprenticeships to people when they're considering their longer-term career and trying to find a niche.
And the big challenge for the industry and lots of industries is the STEM subjects and encouraging youngsters through those. How are we seeing individuals come through and into the more technical and engineering aspects of space-related science?
Well, a lot of that side is looked after by industry, and industry, they are very good. They do have good outreach programs. They do have strong associations with... There are some universities that have stronger sort of space type subjects than others, but the industry tend to build very good relationships with these universities to encourage students, whether it's through an apprenticeship or a full-time job when they actually come out of university. And some of our outreach work as well, although it is limited simply because of resources, we don't have enough people to be doing it all the time. But we do go out to sixth form groups, to universities, you know, sort of potentially to join in with the Milk Round and to explain to people it's not necessarily about working in the UK Space Agency because we are a small group of civil servants. But there's a huge industry out there and there are opportunities for all sorts of people.
And we mentioned NASA several times earlier. What links do you have with NASA and some of their programs that that they're developing?
Yeah, NASA have got some amazing projects underway at the moment. Most of our involvement would be through the European Space Agency because ESA itself works directly with NASA on various collaborative projects, such as missions to Mars. So lots of our involvement would be through ESA rather than directly UK to NASA. But there are groups, there are scientists that work directly with NASA. But for us as the government agency, we tend to go through the European Space Agency and use that as a route into NASA. But, you know, I think there are still areas where there is a bit of a space race. But also people have come to realise resources are limited and the best way is to collaborate, to pool people's resources. And through doing that, you can actually do a lot more.
Okay. And talking about collaboration, I noticed that the UK and Japan have signed an agreement to collaborate together. And I know Japan has quite a strong space programme. Are there any other plans for us to work with other countries or other organisations like that?
Well, we're always open to looking at how we can work with other organisations. Some of these agreements will literally come down to sharing ideas. You know, what sort of work do you do with children? How do you get children interested in STEM subjects? And through working on a bilateral basis with other space agencies, with other governments, you can actually come up with some really, really good ideas without putting money in. You're just sharing information about what you do. But it's certainly an area that we would like to do more of.
We can be very proud of our industry here and some of the technological advances from what was developed at Farnborough through to the recent announcement of Skylon and the power there. And I can see the model on the table there. Very exciting times. How can the UK Space Agency support projects like that?
Well, part of it is obviously financial. Although I keep saying resources are limited.
There is...
We do have funding, so we are able to help. For example, Skylon, it's a bit like the NASA point I made, where the financial support that went in for Skylon to do some of the technical assessments was actually from the European Space Agency.
Right. Okay.
So it's still rooted through there. But the fact that Europe is quite interested and excited in Skylon is good for us. But also publicity, just telling people about this, that we have a space industry, we have a space agency. We all rely on space every day, even if we don't realise it. You know, if you switch off all the satellites, there's suddenly a lot of things that you wouldn't have. So there is the element of just raising the profile of things and getting the ministers interested as well. Yeah. You know, it's great British technology.
Yeah. And very exciting times with those sort of technological advances. What's the future looking like for the UK space industry?
Well, I think the future is very, very positive. The industry actually contributes just over £9 billion a year to the economy, which is a huge contribution. So I think we'll carry on doing things that we're good at. So putting up the satellites there for the Earth monitoring, for provision of services such as satellite television, for example. But also the innovation like the Skylon space plane. The space shuttle, sadly, has now been retired. Yeah. You know, how are we going to get astronauts into space in future? There are other options available at the moment, but people are looking beyond that. It's not just about going to the International Space Station. Are there reasons? Do we have a purpose in going beyond that? Sort of planetary exploration. I think we will continue to contribute to some of the projects that are trying to understand the universe more widely, you know, to understand our own solar system as well. So I think there are all sorts of avenues that the UK space industry can go in It'll continue doing what it's doing, but it'll also be branching out for some of the new technologies.
And you've been very busy yourself recently. You travel a lot. How did Emma get into space and the space industry and UK Space Agency?
Well, it was an unusual route. I've always been, if you like, a sort of space geek ever since I was very, very young and my grandfather got a telescope out and started pointing out the constellations. I've been absolutely fascinated, and I still am absolutely fascinated by space. I think there's so much out there that we don't know about. There's so much to learn about, to try to understand. My own route was through the civil service. I came through the civil service, but I always had in mind I wanted to end up in the space sector.
Yeah.
And when I was studying A-levels, I actually wrote to the European Space Agency and said, you know, one day I'd love to be working for you. What sort of things do I need to do? I actually knew the answer, but part of it was I just wanted a letter back from ESA because, you know, this is in the days before you have 24-hour-a-day access to emails, to the internet and things, so you had to do everything by hand. And they did write back and they said, you know, the usual STEM subjects, etc. And then here I am sort of years later sitting around negotiating tables representing the UK at ESA.
Yeah.
And yes, it was a strange route through the civil service, but I learned a lot along the way that are helping me now in my current position.
Yeah.
Because the space industry is not just about being a researcher or building kits. It's about actually supporting that sort of work as well, which is what a lot of the civil service side actually does.
Yeah. And so what does the Director of Policy and Operations actually do?
Well, the role is quite a wide one. It covers all sorts of things from communications, such as the website, the magazine, through to the management of the budget, through to personnel management, HR, supporting the IT systems. But then some of the other areas, such as regulation, the Outer Space Act is something that my section looks after.
Yeah.
Space weather, space situational awareness, being aware of what's actually out there. So it's huge. And I thoroughly enjoy it. And it's a great, great team of people to work with. I would still say, though, if you said to me, what would you like to be when you grow up? I would probably still say I'd like to be an astronaut.
And we've got an astronaut in training.
We do have, yes, Tim Peake, who is a British astronaut in training with the European Space Agency, Astronaut Corps, doing very, very well. And we hope to see him fly at some point.
Do we know how they will schedule that in, or is it planned? How does that work with the astronauts?
Well, it seems that they actually schedule them sort of years ahead. So they will have crew lined up and training for specific missions. And then they will have a support crew as well. If you've seen the Apollo 13 film, you remember one of the top crew actually had to drop out. So they do have the backups as well, but it is all scheduled quite well in advance, but we don't actually get to see the schedule. That's totally managed by the European Space Agency.
Right. Okay. Well, we keep our fingers crossed it's very soon and we get to see him in space very soon. Emma, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, that was really interesting getting the opportunity to meet Emma. Very difficult individual to get some time with, travelling around Europe, an awful lot of work with ESA, but exciting times.
No, nice work, Peter. I just think my overwhelming response is that it's just such a fantastically positive story, you know, that we have in our little old country. We have got our own space agency and we are doing such good work. It's great stuff. It really is.
Definitely. I mean, I think there's been a sort of a sea change in over time now, in from, you know, the sort of the UK sort of space agency was sort of the sort of icing on the cake, but the transition from BNSC to the space agency, it's got a lot more higher profile now. And I think the important thing at the highest level is ministers are want to back it. You know, we've got a science minister there who's very much hesitant to use space geek, but
he's certainly keen, isn't he?
He seems to me. You know, David Willetts seems to me as to, you know, someone who realizes the opportunities, realizes the potential the UK has for space, and also the potential for space to inspire the next generation. You know, and I think that feeds into the idea, well, the fact we've got now a British astronaut at ESA. Didn't used to have that. The government wasn't really, you know, human spaceflight is something for everybody else. We're not going to be into it. What's in it for us? And now we've got one. I think somebody, people now have realised that the potential of having that human element there to inspire for the next generation to say, you know, yep, you know, you work hard at school, you do your degree, you study the hard subjects, you know, you too could go into space or help somebody else go into space, and that really sort of motivates people.
Yeah. Now, after I spoke to Emma, the UK Space Agency's then acting chief executive, David Parker, released this short joint message, which was jointly produced with the BBC Science Unit, all about UK space history over the past 50 years. It's an interesting listen.
It all often comes as a surprise to discover the pioneering works of UK space programme down the years. Even if you think it's a picture from a European or a NASA spacecraft, it may well be full of UK space technology. Louise Lears at the Weather Centre. Morning, Louise.
Good morning, John. Well, it's been quite a wet night, actually. We've seen some snow as well.
When you get up in the morning, you probably listen to the weather forecast, in which case you're using UK space technology. You might have satellite TV. Well, most of the satellite TV channels are broadcast through British satellites these days. And if you navigate on your way to work or get lost trying to find a restaurant, you're probably using GPS system to try and help you. Well, that's all space technology. It's part of everyday life. Right back just after the dawn of the space age, the United States approached international allies to get involved in their space program, and the UK was the first to respond. And the result was the launch in 1962 of Ariel 1, the first British satellite. And actually, it's hanging out in the Science Museum above Black Arrow, which was the first rocket carrying a British satellite that was launched a few years later in 1971. Most of what we do in space is through international partnership, from the earliest days with NASA, and these days very much through the European Space Agency, which is a 20-nation organisation. And we're really one of the major players in ESA. The mission is called Rosetta, and it's, as you might understand, trying to find the key to the origin of life, perhaps in our solar system. So Rosetta is on its way to a rendezvous with a comet. It will try and go into orbit around the comet as it gets closer to the sun. That's really difficult because a comet doesn't have much gravity. UK industry has built all of the structure and the propulsion system that's getting us to the comet. And then one of the key instruments to sniff out the signs of these chemicals was built by the Open University, and they're one of our leading centres for planetary science. The picture shows a CME blast. What's that? It's a coronal mass ejection when billions of tons of material are thrown off the surface of the sun out into space. SOHO has been sitting about 1.5 million kilometres in front of the Earth, looking at our home star for about 15 or 16 years now. At times, NASA lost control of it, and UK scientists helped recover it after it was thought lost. Planck is observing our whole universe in order to measure to incredible accuracy the so-called cosmic background radiation, the echoes of the Big Bang. Some fantastic scientists around the UK are involved, and also building some of the technology. So, for example, the refrigerators that cool the detectors, the temperature sensors that are used in the experiment, have been done in the UK. They operate at only a few degrees above absolute zero, so minus 250 degrees Celsius. What it's trying to show you is the variation in the gravity depending on where you're standing on our planet. It's been obtained through a truly remarkable spacecraft that goes under the boring and odd name of GOCE, the Gravity and Ocean Circulation Experiment, to understand the distribution of gravity on the Earth, the lumpiness of our planet. And that's really important to understand the tides and currents, and that's important in understanding climate change and making sense of the data we're getting from some other experiments. From a technological point of view, the UK has contributed the iron drive propulsion system, which keeps GOCE in orbit. Although it's false colour imagery, to me it's a work of art. It's looking at cool regions, something you couldn't see with a naked eye. And what it's showing is a region of the sky in the constellation of Cygnus, showing an active region of star formation. The Herschel telescope carries three scientific instruments, and one of them, called Spire, has been led by Matt Griffin at the Cardiff University, one of our leading centres of astronomy. And it's told us a lot about formation of stars and perhaps planetary systems as well. the second largest user of the Hubble Space Telescope is the UK. Our scientists win time on using Hubble because of their excellence. The James Webb Space Telescope, the successor to Hubble. This will be far bigger, deploying giant mirrors, hexagons, deployed out in space, allowing us to see much further back towards the beginning of time. James Webb will carry the mid-infrared instrument, the first instrument that had been delivered for the telescope, and the one led by the United Kingdom. BepiColombo Colombo is in a remarkable spacecraft because it's going to look at the planet Mercury, which of course is very close to the Sun. This presents an enormous engineering challenge, getting our spacecraft to spiral in down to Mercury. So testing it and putting it in the test chambers is really important part of the engineering of this remarkable mission. It will piggyback a Japanese spacecraft aboard the European spacecraft as well. So it's a perfect example of international cooperation in space. I think all of these pictures show you how important the UK has been in the exploration of the universe and continues to be so today. I think we can be really proud of our achievements, of our engineers and our scientists, and I'm sure we're going to contribute a lot more over the 50 years of exploration that is yet to come.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. The UK's had such an active space program that started post-Second World War.
One of the sort of what-ifs, actually, I think, is, you know, post-war, it's always sort of said that the Americans, well, the Americans and the Russians kind of got the rocket scientists, the Americans got the bulk of them, and we got the kind of wind tunnels. So the Americans went off and did Apollo, we got the kind of supersonic wind tunnels, and we went off and did Concorde.
Yeah.
And you wonder a little bit as if, you know, what had happened is if, you know, kind of the roles have been reversed, or perhaps the Allied sectors have changed, or something of that ilk, and we'd actually got the... Would things have been different if we'd got kind of, Werner von Braun?
Instead of Cape Canaveral, we had Portland Bill or somewhere.
Yeah,
Cape Croydon.
I mean, we had no money, but maybe if we'd got von Braun kind of pushing us to build moon rockets, you know, maybe there would have been. I don't know.
But Tim, you got to speak to somebody very exciting this week. You got to speak to Tim Peake earlier this week, didn't you?
I did. Great guy. He is Britain's astronaut at ESA, you know, selected there. He won out over probably 8,000 plus other applicants. He's a former helicopter pilot with the Army Air Corps, former Apache pilot, former test pilot, and you know, he could be the first. He's not the first British astronaut, but he could be the first British astronaut possibly to step on the moon or possibly on an asteroid. So really excited to talk to him. And he's going for training now.
Okay, I'm here, very excited to be interviewing the real-life Dan Dare, pilot of the future, British ESA astronaut Tim Peake for Aviation Extended. Tim, welcome to Extended.
Thank you, Tim. Good to be here.
Tim, you're very excited, obviously, to be speaking to you. What inspired you to fly in the first place? Did you ever think about being an astronaut as a boy?
As a young boy, yes, I think like most sort of young boys and girls do have dreams of being an astronaut, but it really was aviation in my teenage years that inspired me, and that was by joining the cadets at school. And despite being in the Army cadets, they had an Air Force section, and I would go off gliding many weekends with the Air Force guys and just absolutely loved flying. And from there, really, my passion for aviation grew, and I decided to join the Army Air Corps.
And how did your career as a sort of an Apache pilot and rotary wing test pilot sort of prepare you for kind of being an ESA astronaut?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. The ESA astronauts are a real mix, and not just actually within ESA, but across NASA and Roscosmos as well, a real mix of scientists, of engineers, and of pilots. And we all bring different skills, really, and amongst the whole group of us, there's a lot of diversity and expertise. So as an Apache pilot and a qualified test pilot, you have a lot of operational experience, and that helps enormously in terms of managing the space station with regards to the life support systems, also flying the Soyuz spacecraft. Traditionally, European astronauts have the left-hand seat in the Soyuz, which is next to the commander in the center, and you have the responsibility of being able to fly the Soyuz in the event that the commander needs any assistance. And so as a test pilot, you also get involved in the new technologies that are being tested and proven, new procedures, and all sorts of different operational aspects that we can help with. Also, for example, working in the operations center and the communication centers.
Okay. I mean, you beat out, obviously, sort of thousands of applicants about 4 years ago to get this sort of dream job. I mean, how is the astronaut training going so far? Is it what you expected?
I'm not sure what I expected. it's an interesting job, but that is without a doubt, and there is no danger of being bored. There are no two days that are the same, really. It's extremely varied. There's a lot of travel involved. Lots of our training takes place in Moscow at Star City or at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. But I've been lucky enough also to be involved in missions such as the NEMO mission, that's NASA's Extreme Environments mission, which was underwater in Florida for 12 days last year. I've also spent 2 weeks living down a cave in Sardinia, as well as sort of parabolic flights that are thrown in there as well, on top of the routine day-to-day jobs, which are more along the lines of giving support to the guys who are on board the station by doing Eurocom jobs. So we talk to the International Space Station, we talk to the astronauts on board.
And sort of like as a sort of comparison to, I've read and talked to people about the sort of, you know, the Apache training, which is one of the most sort of intensive and difficult flying jobs there is. How does that compare to, in sort of the sort of difficulty or the intensity of being an astronaut, the sort of training?
I think the intensity is less overall, except for those periods where you're going to have emergency situations. And when we do train for emergency situations, either as Eurocom, which is the communications, or as the crew, then yes, there are extremely intense situations and you really need to be on the ball, just as you would in an aviation environment. But for the routine training, then it's a long duration training event, and there is lots of variety. It's kind of being a jack of all trades, if you like, and hopefully a master of some of them. But the training is very, very good, just like you'd expect from this environment, as it is in the aviation environment, and it really thoroughly prepares you for what you've got coming during your mission.
Are you the only sort of helicopter rated sort of test pilot astronaut that you know of, or?
No, there have been several. In fact, Sunny Williams, a NASA astronaut, she's just recently come down from commanding the space station last year. Had a very successful mission with two spacewalks as well. She's a Navy US test pilot.
Okay. And you mentioned obviously going underwater with NEMO and also going kind of caving as part of your astronaut training. Can you explain, you know, what's that all about, and what does that sort of, how does that sort of prepare you for life in outer space?
Yeah, well, these are really space analogs, they're called, which the aim is to try and simulate or give an environment where you can inject stressors in a small international crew, similar to onboard a spacecraft, and that enables the crew to be able to work together as a team, exercising all sorts of different sort of psychological and social skills in terms of leadership, followership and decision making, etc. So the cave environment is great because you've got high levels of isolation. It takes about 8 hours just to get to the base camp in the cave, and there's lots of vertical ascent and descent, so it's lots of technical ability to get there as well. It's not a cave that your average tourist would go down to. You need to be extremely well qualified with lots of technical equipment just to get there. So once we're there, we're actually doing genuine exploration as well. This cave system in Sardinia has got miles of unexplored area, so we're exploring those areas, we're mapping the cave as we go, and we're doing scientific research as well, taking biological samples, soil samples, for example. And on top of that, we're doing photography tasks, and cave photography is quite tricky in order to get the lighting correct. And obviously photography on board the space station is very important too. So there are lots of similarities in the cave environment with EVA activities and other spaceflight activities. So it's a great analog for training.
Okay.
Now, the NEMO mission underwater is similar, and the fact that you're actually living down at 20 meters, you're completely completely saturated, so there is no ability to go to the surface without going through decompression. Otherwise, you risk a severe risk of injury from the bends and decompression illness. So you've had that elevated level of risk of isolation, and once again, you're doing scientific work. Now, NEMO was slightly different because we were specifically researching an asteroid mission. We also had a 50-second communication delay to simulate a sort of 15 million kilometer asteroid. So that was slightly different. But again, it's a space analog that puts the crew into these environments.
Okay. And what about a sort of a typical sort of ESA's astronaut day like? I mean, apart from the kind of cool stuff like weightlessness training, is there much sort of paperwork and academic study required?
Yes, there really is no such thing as certainly not in the sort of 3.5 years I've been with ESA, there's no such thing as a typical day. It tends to go through, you tend to go through blocks of training, and they are scheduled well in advance, and you might be going off to Russia to do Soyuz right or left-hand seat training or study the Russian segment of the space station. Last year I spent a lot of time in Houston in the neutral buoyancy laboratory learning how to do spacewalking, EVA activity. But an average day, there is also administration to do. There is paperwork. We also are given management tasks to do so that we have a sort of career profile within ESA. So we come back from a mission, we can be usefully employed in management roles. So there's a huge amount of variety in terms of what we're doing. But in the pre-assignment phase, the training really takes priority. And then we try and fit everything else in around that.
Okay. And do you get involved in kind of outreach initiatives as well, so talking to students and schools and stuff? And do you...
Yes, most definitely. Last week I was back at King's College London doing a presentation, which I've given for 3 years now, to the courses. They've got a bachelor's course and a master's course, bachelor's in extreme physiology and a master's in space health and medicine. Which is extremely successful, and it's always very interesting to speak to the students. They're always very engaging and very enthusiastic about human spaceflight. And certainly space microgravity is an excellent area to study human physiology. And we do more general educational outreach work, activities such as Mission X, which is coming up this year again, which is train like an astronaut, so trying to get young adults involved in good, healthy eating and exercise.
Okay. And will you be tweeting from outer space, like is it Commander Hadfield on the ISS at the moment?
I certainly will be, yes. Yeah, I sort of joined Twitter last year just before the NEMO mission, so I tweeted during NEMO, and I'll be tweeting on my ISS mission most definitely. I think Chris Hadfield's doing a fantastic job, and you know, the images that he's sending back every day are just really inspiring.
As an ESA astronaut, then, what are your thoughts then on the joint US-European Orion ATV deep space spacecraft that's been sort of given the green light recently? Do you expect to fly on that at some point?
I certainly would like to see a European astronaut fly on it, yes. I think it's an absolutely fantastic progress that we've made. And the fact that Europe and NASA have joined together on this project is great. International collaboration gives stability to these projects, and it helps them to progress. That's why the ISS has been so successful. And I think now we're looking to the future. You're looking at doing things and going places where one nation really can't go it alone. Everybody needs to contribute to the next steps, the goals of the moon, asteroids, and eventually Mars. So the fact that Europe is on board with NASA is wonderful, and we are providing the service module to Orion is great as well. And yes, hopefully that will be the barter element involved there will enable a European astronaut at some point to fly.
And do you know when you kind of expect to fly to? Is there a sort of a flight order in your group or seniority, or who chooses the mission, and who do you have to butter up or give brown envelopes full of cash to?
Thankfully, we don't have to get involved in that. We don't worry about that. Flight assignments are taken care of, are really at the highest level.
Right.
And all ESA astronauts are qualified to the same level, and we're all able to do any of the missions. So we just continue with our training program and wait for the assignments to come in. But the great news is that Europe has been very successful in the past of flying all of their astronauts at least once, most multiple times. And we already have three of my class of six of 2009, already three of them are assigned. That's Luca, Alex, and Samantha. And we have a further three flights available between now and 2015 and 2020. So we've got plenty of flight opportunities, which is great.
Excellent. Okay. And so once you there's a sort of a hard date sort of set for a mission, how long would the sort of mission specific training phase last? What sort of run us through the kind of sort of pre-mission kind of the sort of phase of how would the run up work?
It takes about 2.5 years to go through the pre-assignment training. And it depends on what qualifications and skills you may have. For example, Luca came straight out of basic training and went into about a 2.5 year training program. And you have to get qualified at a certain level for all of the segments on the space station. So the Russian segments, the US lab, the Japanese laboratory, the European laboratory, Columbus, as well as being a good operator on the robotic arm, the Canada arm.
Yeah.
That's very important these days because many of the modules that are visiting the space station do not have automatic docking capability. The European and the European ATV and the Russian Progress do, but for example, the Japanese HTV and SpaceX and in the future Cygnus will all have to be grappled by the robotic arm and then manually docked to the station. So that's a skill that needs to be learned. Also EVA, that's another major task for an astronaut. And in the days of the shuttle when the ISS was being constructed, the crews would generally go up for a sort of 10-day mission with several EVAs that they had practiced and rehearsed many, many times in the pool in Houston in terms of construction of the ISS. We're now entering the phase where the majority of the ISS is built, although there's always a couple of more modules in the pipeline, but we're into the phase where it's maintenance and repair. Mm. And the EVAs that are coming along now are those that are unscheduled and the astronauts wouldn't have specifically trained for.
Okay.
And this presents a great challenge because it also can occur towards the end of your increment. That was exactly the case last year with Sonny Williams and Aki Hoshide, who had to go on two EVAs in order to do an unscheduled maintenance activity. So it's a very challenging environment, and EVA is certainly a very, very physically and mentally demanding skill to have. I went through the training last year, absolutely loved it, but it's I thoroughly enjoyed all the training. It's by far the most challenging that I've come across so far.
Yeah, okay, excellent. As a Brit, I mean, one of the most exciting things really is that the UK government has kind of reversed its long-standing official, I don't know, opposition or at least lukewarm sort of approach to getting involved in and funding manned spaceflight. What would you ascribe this change of heart to?
I think it's just been a gradual build-up. There's been this sort of underlying momentum within the UK space industry. And in the days of the BNSC, it really was a sort of hidden secret that our space industry was so successful. And, giving sort of 7 to 10% returns throughout the years of recession and still continues to do so. And I think it's recognition of that successful area of growth as an industry, along with the BNSC becoming the UK Space Agency, and that kind of gave everything momentum. And then I was selected an astronaut. We also had many UK scientists and researchers who were trying to advertise the merits of microgravity research, and that was all coming to the UK Space Agency and to the government from different directions. So it's been a gradual build-up, a gradual momentum that has got to us where we are now today, which is that we've joined Ellipse 4, which is wonderful, so UK scientists and researchers can now lead experiments in microgravity using all the facilities that ESA offers. And the UK has invested into the Orion MPCV element, which is great.
I mean, there are obviously still significant challenges in sort of space medicine and long duration sort of space flight and the kind of human factors aspect of space travel. Is this somewhere where the UK could contribute and have a sort of niche?
Most definitely, yeah. I think that's possibly one of our strongest areas. It's not an area that I'm an expert in by any means, but the people that I'm speaking to, and when I go back, for example, and to King's College London, and there we have now a UK space biomedicine consortium of over 30 members just within that one space biomedicine area. We have people, for example, at Southampton University studying intracranial pressure, which is a problem, a very recent problem that's been identified with astronauts for long-duration spaceflight, which impairs vision. And these are areas where the UK really can lead. We have lots of experts who are within the space medicine domain. And not only is an area that we can lead, but it's also an area that really gives great terrestrial benefits to the elderly population in terms of osteoporosis and okay. healthcare for the elderly.
All right, okay, that's interesting. This year also should see Virgin Galactic and X-Corps make milestone flights with their suborbital vehicles. What are your views on sort of space tourism and private enterprise opening up the kind of final frontier?
I think it's great. I think it's absolutely wonderful that so many people are firstly interested in space is wonderful, and secondly that commercial companies obviously have found ways of viable ways of making it a good business proposition to fly people to space. And as soon as you start flying people to space, then we can start doing more scientific activities as well on the back of that. And Virgin Galactic, the Farnborough Air Show, were already advertising the possibility of launching satellites from their suborbital spaceship too, which would be hopefully reducing the cost of access to space for schools and universities, etc., in the future. And that means more people can have access to the microgravity environment and the space environment in order to study it. So no, I'm a huge fan of the commercial endeavours. I think it's a great direction to be moving in.
So yeah, you haven't got a bet on then with Virgin Galactic's chief test pilot, Dave Mackay, then as to who's going again to space first?
No, I haven't got a bet. And if I did, I wouldn't tell you who it was either.
I mean, you mentioned before about the kind of variety of astronauts, backgrounds that there are, but for Brits and for anybody else, young people who might be listening to this and who are desperate to go into space in the future, you know, key question, what advice would you give? What should they be doing?
I mean, that's a really tough question, actually, because as I alluded to earlier, when you look around the office here, we've all come, all the European astronauts have come from so many different backgrounds, it's impossible to say this is what you need to do. The only thing I would say is that every one of us has been very passionate about what we've been doing. We've tried to be as good as we can be. And really, it doesn't matter if you're a medical doctor, an engineer, a scientist, a pilot. You can enter into the space industry from all of these different areas. And it's in many respects, it's the psychological, social skills that you have that are very important. Certainly, looking to the future for long duration space flight, it's those kind of areas and aspects that are almost the non-trainable skills. They're the ones that count.
Okay.
But anybody who's passionate about what they do and who's got the ability to get on in an international environment will be well suited for spaceflight.
So looking ahead, where do you think the next where do you think the next human footsteps will be placed on? You know, the moon, asteroids, or Mars? Or and if you were to select your own mission, if you had that privilege, where would you like to go?
Okay, I still think the next human footprints will be back on the moon, although there is clearly a lot of interest in asteroids at the moment. I still think Mars is something for the 2030s at the earliest opportunity, hopefully the 2030s, if not a little bit beyond that. But I would personally, in what I see as feasible within my career time frame, I would love an asteroid mission. That would be my ambition, especially having worked with NASA's exploration branch last year, specifically on looking at asteroid missions. I think that would be an absolutely fascinating mission to undertake.
Brilliant. Okay. I mean, obviously, you get some sort of, we get some people who say, you know, we can do a lot more science for less money with unmanned probes, rovers, and robotics. You know, it's something much more advanced. Why are we sending humans? What does a human bring to exploration?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with a lot more science with unmanned probes. I think that the science that has been done, you know, despite the success of rovers such as Spirit and Opportunity vastly outweighing their lifetime, the amount of science that could have been done by a human in a one-week, one-month mission would have exceeded all of the science that could have been done by those rovers. And as rover missions become more complex, then they become much more expensive, and we're now looking at sort of multi-billion dollar missions to Mars for rover missions. So the cost is now creeping up there towards the sort of human spaceflight element. But having said that, I think robots and humans work together the best, and there is actually these days there's much less animosity between those branches than there used to be in the past. Obviously, there is a pot of funding that both areas are trying to get the same funding, or funding from the same pot. But these days, robotics and human spaceflight work closely together because I think both areas understand that you each rely on one another. Robotics are definitely the best use for the higher risk missions, paving the way, going to areas that humans either can't go today because of the technology, in order to de-risk those missions and to provide those initial bits of science. But what the human brings later on is human ingenuity and initiative and decision making, and the ability to actually go and stand somewhere and do a lot more science using the human brain, which today still is far superior to any robot that can be built.
Yeah. What would your ex-army colleagues and family make of you becoming a sort of an astronaut? When you're in the UK and you're at sort of shops or parties and people sort of say, "What do you do?" and you say, "I'm an astronaut," do people sort of think you're having a joke, or you're pulling their leg?
Yes, I try not to say it actually as much as possible. If people don't know, I try and avoid the subject because it can be a real conversation stopper. But no, my close family and friends are absolutely normal about the idea, and I think they understand the training that I'm going through and the fact that it's extremely extremely intensive training, but also a long process. And hopefully, at the end of the day, I will get a flight to space, which would be the ultimate goal. But it can certainly be quite interesting when you tell people what you do.
And okay, and then finally, you might even be flying on a Soyuz or even an Orion spacecraft in the future. But what's your favourite fictional spacecraft?
I think it has to be the USS Enterprise.
Ah, right, okay. But which one?
Well, I'm not a huge Star Trek fan, but certainly when I was a younger kid, then I would watch Star Trek and just loved the idea of exploring, exploring the universe at warp speed and going to strange places. Either that or the X-wing fighter from Star Wars.
Okay, that's both sort of sets of sci-fi fans covered then.
Yeah.
Okay, and just to round off then, you're going to be talking at the Royal Aeronautical Society in February, is that right?
That's right, yes.
So that's 7th of February in London.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for speaking to us, and look forward to hearing your lecture in February, and good luck with the rest of the training.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Yeah, it's interesting he gets to potentially fly across the various platforms. He could possibly fly Soyuz or Orion. And I heard, actually, interestingly, the Italian astronaut Paolo Nespoli said that the shuttle was a really smooth ride, but the Soyuz return was shockingly jarring and quite uncomfortable. So potentially Tim Peake could fly on either platform.
That's right, yeah. Not only that, but one of the other things that interesting that he sort of said was about, and this comes also from an upcoming interview with Andrew Smith, that the astronauts have, because he's a a test pilot, he also has sort of design input into the next generation sort of spacecraft and cockpits and things like that. So yeah, really interesting.
That's such a lovely throwback, right back to the start. You know, when the Mercury 7, those first
seven
guys were named. You know, one of them was given guidance, another one was given life support, captain design, and all those sorts of things. And that went right through Gemini, you know, Apollo into Skylab, then the shuttle. These are not. I love the sort of Dan Dare comment, but you know, these are not guys sort of just turning up and you know, giving a big white smile to the crowd and then blasting off. You know, these guys are properly involved.
And there's one thing that I think also is important for anyone listening who's maybe young, wants to get into space. I think, you know, I asked you a question about what do you need to be an astronaut, and you know, what are they looking for these days? And you know, because of the varied backgrounds of the astronauts he comes into contact, there is no, you know, sort of one solution to, oh yeah, you just be a military test pilot, you do this, you do X, you'll be selected. No, you know, it's still the very select few, it's still an elite. But most importantly, he said, was the passion.
Yeah.
You know, to have a passion for space, and to have a passion for the job, and passion for sort of exploration, for passion for kind of learning stuff. You know, I think that's a real sort of optimistic and kind of good message to get across to people.
Yeah.
Who will be the first member of the extended team to go into orbit? That is the question.
And on that note, we'll come on to our next exciting item, and that's our competition for this episode. We've heard from Emma and also from Tim Peake, obviously both sponsored by the UK Space Agency. And Emma mentioned in our interview the Ministerial Council meeting, and she set the question. And the question is, in which city was the European Space Agency Ministerial Council meeting held last November? Now, she's promised to put a prize up for the correct answer, so that
is
will
it
be
a trip
quite
to space?
Not quite that good a prize. I think we'll get something, some merchandise from the UK Space Agency, which is very kind of them to support the show. But if you know the answer, it's get involved at aviationextended.co.uk and put episode 9 space competition in the title. Don't forget your name and address, as the prize for the UK Space Agency will need to be posted onto you. The closing date for entries is February the 15th, so there's plenty of time to get your entries in. The winner will be selected randomly from all the successful answers. And so, on to our next segment. NASA, to me, has always been the dominant player in space exploration, and I got the opportunity to talk to Gene Mikulka about what they're up to. Now, Gene describes himself as a freelance space pundit, but he's also a technical writer. He's most well known, though, as the panelist and presenter on the famous Talking Space program. He's also a presenter and producer of Spaceflight Observer, and in simple terms, he's an expert and one of the nicest guys around. Gene, welcome to Extended.
Privileged to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, it's an absolute delight to have you on the program. I've so enjoyed being a listener to Talking Space and Spaceflight Observer as well. So it's a delight to have you. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're too kind. And by the way, your own program is quite a great listen too. So you've got a new fan here. So thanks.
Wonderful, wonderful. We've struggled with some of our American listeners, so we can chalk you up as one of our new ones. And staying stateside, we've just seen the retirement of the shuttle, and I think Mark Ratterman described the shuttle on the last Talking Space program as a lot of people have only given it attention now it's been retired. What's the legacy that the shuttle has left us?
Well, the biggest legacy orbits overhead every 90 minutes. It's the International Space Station.
Yeah,
it is a huge facility. It's about 900 metric tons. It's about the size of a U.S. Regulation football field. It's easily visible at night if you go outside and know where to look. NASA's got a pretty good website to go ahead and if you're trying to find where the ISS is. But I think the one of the biggest legacies is obviously the International Space Station and what comes out of that.
Yeah.
The shuttle, when it was first established, it was actually supposed to be part of a system. In 1972, after the Apollo program, the idea was, well, all right, what do we do now? And there were basically three ideas on the table.
One was to go ahead and shoot for Mars. And that was, if you can believe it, that was being looked at seriously for a 1984 launch opportunity.
Right.
The other one was to go ahead and try to develop the tools that we had from Apollo a little bit more and possibly establish a permanent base on the moon, sort of like a McMurdo style, like the base in Antarctica.
Sure. Yeah.
That was one of the other plans on the books. And another one was called Earth Orbit Applications, which is eventually what we kind of went with, but we went with initially a watered-down version of it. It included a space telescope, a orbiting piloted platform, and a shuttlecraft to service the two, to service the telescope and to service the orbiting platform of the space station.
Right, okay.
Well, the Nixon administration at the time killed the telescope, killed the space station idea. In fact, space station was a bad word in NASA in the early 70s, and just left the shuttle. So the shuttle was never really supposed to be the centerpiece of the U.S. space program, but all of a sudden it became it.
Yeah.
And it was kind of sort of a program looking for a purpose for a long time. But there were Earth resource applications being supposedly come out of that. It was supposed to launch, serve as a platform to launch satellites and so on. But it really, the purpose of it really wasn't really clearly defined, at least in my mind. If you go ahead and take a look at the literature from the 70s, it also was supposed to have a much more quick and more abundant flight capability. I think at one point they were talking about 50 flights a year. Good luck with that. Exactly. I mean, we really didn't understand the machine just yet. But we had just, the shuttle itself, I'm not going to knock the program. The program, without the shuttle, the International Space Station would not exist.
Right.
And without shuttle, Hubble would not exist.
Yeah.
And without shuttle, a lot of other programs and a lot of other things would not exist out there. For instance, a lot of the interplanetary probes, they were designed specifically, like Galileo and so on. They were designed specifically to fit in to the shuttle cargo bay, and that cargo bay was pretty big. I mean, you could fit four elephants in that cargo bay. That's how big it was. So
right, okay. Jim, what was it like around Kennedy for the launch of a shuttle?
Yeah, I was actually invited as part of the what used to be called the NASA Tweet Up. Now they're called NASA Socials. I was actually lucky enough to be selected for one or two of them.
Yeah.
One was STS-129 and the other one was STS-132. The atmosphere is really interesting around there. One thing that kind of took me aback, though, for 129 and 132 was there really wasn't a lot of a huge press presence there. There was press out there. There was the usual folks that you would see from the local television stations and so on, and plus the old soldiers that would cover these flights. They were around, but there really wasn't the phalanx of press that we saw for STS-135.
And is there more interest now in space exploration and travel, or was it just the retirement of the shuttle that seemed to invigorate interest in the space sector?
I think actually it was the announcement of the last shuttle flight that kind of sort of looked, kind of reinvigorated things, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
My own experience from covering two shuttle flights as press was STS-134 and STS-135. And it was the difference between the press coverage between 134 and 135 were light years.
Yeah.
I got in at, I think it was like 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning for the launch of STS-135 because I wanted to be there for tanking. And I was looking in back of me and I remembered what KSC was like for STS-129.
Yeah.
And it was like you know, where were you guys? You know, because to me, the same risks that the crew of STS-135 were about ready to undertake existed for STS-129. Yeah. They existed for STS-60.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, you know, I've got this wall of press behind me, literally. I mean, they're you know, these monolithic towers and things like that that are waiting for everybody to start coming in and you know, lighting things up and so on.
Yeah.
And I'm like, where were you guys for those flights? Those flights, they had the same amount of risk, they had the same amount of danger, they had the same amount of reward, and you guys didn't seem to want to cover that. You guys, but here we are for the last one, and you're all here. You know, thank you for being here, but you're all here too late.
And shuttle's over now. They've all gone off to their various resting places. And
interesting way of putting it, by the way.
Yeah, well, we're all... It's a living, breathing animal, really, isn't it? And let's hope that they can keep them presented in a way that, I suppose, befits that. But the USA finds itself in really difficult financial times. That interest in the last shuttle flights and the shuttles being rehomed hasn't really helped, and NASA's had massive cuts in its budgets. How's it faring? What's the future like?
Oh boy, that's something we're still actually trying to sort out. I will say that we do have NASA has two new spacecraft under development right now. They're actually carryovers. One of them is an actually direct carryover from the now defunct Constellation program, which was going to go ahead and return us to the moon. That spacecraft is called Orion, and by the way, it looks like the European Space Agency is also going to have a good role with Orion as well. It will be taking the automated transfer vehicle, or ATV,
yeah,
sort of a hybrid from that, and adapting it to Orion, and thus the a modified version of the ATV will essentially become the service module for the Orion spacecraft. To describe Orion, it's sort of like the Apollo spacecraft on steroids. You know, that's basically what it's been billed at. I believe it can carry four astronauts, and it is being called the multi-purpose crew vehicle because, again, it's trying to be flexible. It's trying to adapt to several missions. I believe its first piloted mission, which I think is scheduled right now for 2021, yeah, is supposed to repeat the Apollo 8 mission from 1968 and go around the moon and come back, just to test the vehicle and make sure that you know, the avionics are working and everything, yeah, is up to snuff, and that it could handle the rigors of an interplanetary space mission.
NASA, even though it's under extreme budgetary pressure, was astonished to see that it's still delivering over 100 space missions at the moment. You know, obviously, you know, we've talked about the ISS, but some of the other programs are absolutely amazing that it's working on. With the finances being so precarious, are all of those programs going to carry on? I mean, NASA's already dropped out of the ESA. Is it the ExoMars?
That's correct. That was a whole big deal.
Yeah.
And in the same breath, which really kind of had us scratching our heads over here a little bit, was, okay, fine, we dropped out of ExoMars, but yet we announced two new Mars initiatives.
Yeah.
And one is called InSight, which is a, you know, sort of a redress of the Mars Phoenix lander. But except this one is going to go ahead and drill even deeper into the Martian surface and try to find out what's going on under there.
Yeah.
And of course, Curiosity Mark II, which is going to be solar powered rather than RTG powered.
Yeah.
But
right.
Again, it kind of left us scratching our heads a little bit, you know, because they're estimating Curiosity 2, for lack of a better phrase, at $1.5 billion, and I'm still kind of wondering where that money's going to come from.
And with all these Mars missions, and ESA's also in the process of sending satellites, obviously we've got MSL,
and Curiosity there. We've got these new projects for 2016. Are there too many Mars missions at the moment? Why shouldn't we focus on the Moon? Because we know we can get there. We've got men there. And we still really haven't fathomed that one out, have we?
I like that question. That's a question I've sort of asked myself.
Yeah.
We've actually had a bunch of unpiloted missions back to the lunar surface. One, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is still hard at work. The other one is the LCROSS mission, which was designed to go ahead and try to see what kind of, you know, is there really, you know, water and ice over there? Is it abundant? And, you know, essentially the LCROSS sort of smashed into the lunar surface to find out what might be in the ejecta. And the LRO just swept by and found that out. And we found out, hey, the Moon is actually wetter than we actually thought it was. We had the GRAIL mission just conclude.
Gene, can I just ask you a question?
Sure.
One of the challenges that besets all nations at the moment is space debris.
Right. Exactly.
The question I was going to ask is, why did we then crash the GRAIL probes into the Moon? Isn't that creating more debris and litter around the universe?
Well, the GRAIL probes were starting to run out of fuel, and if you can go ahead and have a controlled impact rather than these things crashing into wherever, the idea too is to make sure that they steered clear from any of the Apollo landing sites, because those are sort of been declared
historic sites.
Exactly, historic sites. Yeah, so the idea was you didn't want these two orbiting artifacts to crash anywhere.
Yeah.
And to relate that to the space debris problem, that's the idea too here too. We don't want orbiting debris that's still up there to impact just anywhere. We want to bring it in a controlled fashion.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's what we did with GRAIL, with the twin GRAIL probes. We made sure that they were brought in over an area where they're not going to be a problem, and that they would not pose a threat to any of the Apollo landing sites.
Right, okay. I was listening to one of the project managers on the Cassini project, which was, this is Saturn, isn't it? And
right.
They were looking to the probe that's going on to, is it Titan? And they were talking about how the satellite still had enough energy to continue to operate, and that the way that they would manage its demise, I suppose, was to burn it up in the atmosphere, which seems the cleverest way. Is that generally how these things work?
Yeah, because you don't want to contaminate the area, and that's essentially why a lot of these probes come in and have a fiery demise, because you don't want to contaminate something that's not from Earth with a probe that was sent from Earth. There's still the possibility. I mean, Apollo 12 taught us an interesting lesson. Actually, it was Surveyor 3 when the Apollo 12 astronauts brought back a piece of the Surveyor spacecraft. It was found that apparently a technician had sneezed on a component on the spacecraft, and those microbes apparently survived.
Wow.
Lunar, yeah. So you want to make sure that in case of any type of contamination, that the vehicle is disposed of properly, and that that another world will not be contaminated by the Earth.
And talking about something that's going on and currently not programmed for its demise is the Voyager probes, launched over 30 years ago, and now they're approaching, I think it's called interstellar space, and leaving our solar system. What happens next with something like that?
Well, Voyager 1 and 2, good Lord, wow. I mean, you want to talk about an incredible mission right there.
11 billion miles away.
Yeah, I mean,
incomprehensible. I can't get my head around it.
Exactly. I mean, here's a thought. When they were launched in 1977, I was in grade school. So, so I was just completing grade school. So it's just incomprehensible to me that these probes, A, have functioned as long as they had, and B, delivered some wonderful science. I mean, Voyager 1 gave us a good view of Jupiter and Saturn before, you know, going off, and Voyager 2 just about completed the grand tour going to Uranus and Neptune.
Yeah.
And also, I believe, may have been the spacecraft to turn its camera on one final time and kind of sort of take a photograph of the solar system from its vantage point, some, you know, 9 or 10 billion miles out,
yeah,
and had taken a really interesting picture, which inspired Carl Sagan to call it the pale blue dot. In fact, Sagan, I believe, was the individual that asked for those photographs and asked that for those to be turned on. So we would have to thank the late Carl Sagan for all that. But it is just been an amazing mission.
Yeah.
And we haven't gone into interstellar space just yet. There was an announcement just this past month about that. Where Voyager is, it's essentially called, and I'm looking at a website here from NASA.gov, it's essentially called the Magnetic Highway.
Right.
It's been in this little region of space since, I believe, according to NASA, since July of this year, and it's this magnetic highway is sort of an area where the sun's magnetic field connects up to the magnetic field of interstellar space, and so we're not exactly out of, you know, yeah, out of the solar system just yet, but we're darn close.
Right.
And I mean, that's exciting. it's still heady stuff. And yeah, the idea of when you talk to the project manager about that, Ed Stone, he was saying, yeah, we kind of sort of planned for these vehicles to be still functional. I mean, you turn on instruments and gosh darn it, after 35 years, they're still functioning. I believe, yeah, there's enough fuel on board Voyager for until about 2025, and that's when they're going to have to start playing around with, okay, what do we keep on, what do we keep off, that type of thing.
Right.
And I believe you can still do engineering stuff past that point. But I believe after, I guess, 2025, 2030, that time frame, you know, it's basically going to be very difficult to keep contact with these two spacecraft. But it's still amazing to me that they're still in wonderful shape.
Mind-boggling. It's what keeps me gripped, I suppose, by it.
Yeah.
This whole topic. A bit closer to home.
Yes, sir.
NASA is continuing to develop its deep space projects and its space missions, and I suppose its remit seems to be changing a little bit, and now we're talking about commercial players coming in, SpaceX, and this sort of thing. Can you tell us a little bit about what the future holds over the next couple of years?
Oh boy,
for those programs.
Sure. Well, back around February 2010, we were still trying to figure out what we were going to do with the piloted end of spaceflight post shuttle. The current sitting president, President Barack Obama, decided to cancel the Constellation program, which was going to go ahead and bring us back to the moon that then President George Bush had set up.
Right.
To be fair, the Bush administration did not give Constellation a lot of support, and it was essentially almost $9 billion in the hole. So the idea was to go ahead and just, you know, all right, cut our losses and let's figure out something else. So in February 2010, after another panel then headed by Norm Augustine from Lockheed, and, you know, infamous for the Augustine's laws and so on. But after that little panel had made three recommendations. One was to continue the program of record, which was Constellation. Two, a direct shot to Mars, which again, they felt was kind of problematic because we didn't have the technology for it. Right. The third was sort of this flexible path type thing. And that's what we're kind of sort of on, I think. To answer your question as far as commercial, it was decided in February of 2010 that we go ahead and turn over low Earth operations to commercial companies and try to develop low Earth orbit, you know, for business and commerce and so on.
Yeah.
And that commercial companies would be also responsible for getting U.S. astronauts to the International Space Station. That was, by the way, never supposed to be Plan A. It was actually supposed to be Plan C.
Okay.
And that was actually put in place strictly for cargo by Michael Griffin, who was then NASA administrator under President Bush. So give some kudos to where it belongs. But the idea was to go ahead and have these commercial firms that want to go ahead and develop low Earth orbit to do so. So we have companies like Space Exploration Technologies, otherwise known as SpaceX, developing the Dragon spacecraft, which has had two launches thus far. One test flight back in May, which docked with the ISS.
Yeah.
The paying flight, which just occurred, CRS-1.
Yeah.
Which on first glance looked really good, but on paper, not so much. There were some issues there that they still have to work on, and so on. So the CRS-2 flight, which was supposed to be, I believe, scheduled for February, has been pushed back to March while they go ahead and try to figure out what, to put the pieces back together from all that. But
right.
So they're one player on the field. Another company, tried and true, Boeing, they have what is called the CST-100, which is like the Dragon spacecraft, a conical-shaped vehicle.
Yeah.
But CST-100 is being built specifically for piloted flight, whereas Dragon is built for cargo and piloted flight. Both vehicles, both CST-100 and Dragon, can hold 7 crew. But Dragon essentially returns something that we didn't have for a very long time, or at least after Shuttle ended, we didn't have it anymore. And that's the ability to return things from the International Space Station.
Okay. And Gene, just normally, I mean, when ESA sends a rocket up or whatever and it connects to the space station, when it's returning, does it burn up in the atmosphere? Do they use, I suppose, the module to dispose of any waste and burn it up in the atmosphere? Is that how it's normally done?
That's correct. The automated transfer vehicle, or ATV, does burn up in the atmosphere.
Right.
Ditto with Japan's HTV, which is somewhat similar to the same thing.
Right.
The Russian Progress module also does that. Dragon does not, and that's the big plus.
Yeah.
There's another vehicle that we are developing here, a company called Orbital Sciences. They are developing something called the Cygnus, which also is a direct cargo vehicle, but would also burn up in the atmosphere as well. So this way you can get rid of the trash, basically, that's on board this thing. I mean, everybody who lives in a house, they know stuff accumulates and you have to get rid of it.
And
so you wait for the cleanup crew to come over and do that. And that's what these other spacecraft are, basically the ATV, HTV, Progress, and soon Cygnus, which is scheduled for launch, I hope, in for April of this year, of 2013. I would be remiss, too. There's another player in the commercial space game here, too, as far as bringing crew to the International Space Station, and that's a company called Sierra Nevada. They're actually developing something called the Dream Chaser, which was, in reality, a program that NASA had abandoned in the 1990s due to as we had mentioned before, budget cuts, called the HL-20. They have rechristened this thing the Dream Chaser. It can hold 7 crew, but the neat part about this is it is essentially a mini shuttle. And if you look at it, it looks like, a baby space shuttle.
Yeah.
And the other interesting component to Dream Chaser will be that it has, quote, green fuels, close quote, which means that if it had to, it could land on, pretty much any airport that could service it.
Wow.
And you're not going to have the problem that you had with Shuttle, where you had all these noxious fumes and gases around the vehicle when it came in. Literally, after the vehicle cools down, you can pop the hatch and climb out, with no problems. So, they were the third runner in the whole program, and they did receive money under the commercial crew program. So. Again, they are going to be another company to watch.
Right, Gene, we're running a little low on time, and I've still got so many more questions that I'd love to ask you. So we'd love you to come back on onto the show and talk to us a little bit more about some of these other exciting projects.
We'd be delighted.
But before we go, can you just tell us a little bit about Talking Space and Space Flight Observer?
Sure. Talking Space was established in 2009, around September. The idea for it actually stems all the way back to, I guess, early, like 2003, 2004. Radio programs on demand were just absolutely amazing, and there was some really good science and astronomy podcasts out there that I was really totally addicted to, but there was one program I was looking for and it wasn't out there. It was essentially to be sort of a pundit program, if you will, just talking about the news of the day, sort of the way I kind of like describe it. It would be sort of like taking the headlines from spaceflight the way, you know, the pundits out there take, you know, political news and just kicking it around and kind of really examining it. And I couldn't find that program anywhere. So I said, well, shoot, why I just try to do it myself? And I have to really thank Veronica McGregor, who really started the whole tweet up thing, because without her, I don't think really Talking Space would have existed.
Well, it's certainly a fantastic listen. I've really, really enjoyed the last couple of years, and not being a specialist or a technician or an engineer or a space scientist, you give us enough to understand what's going on, but in enough detail to really get to the bottom of the issues. So really enjoy it.
I appreciate that, sir, and I'll pass that along to my my colleagues, Mr. Mark Ratterman and Mr. Sawyer Rosenstein and Gina Hurley, and also Anthony Fitch, who helps me out on Observer. Again, Observer's been in hiatus for a little bit. We're planning on to, you know, drive into some more information, but we're going to be more drilling down into like maybe one or two topics where Talking Space has sort of a 50,000 foot level discussion. That's what Observer is going to be all about, and I can't wait to relight that candle and coming up in January. So
I'm excited about that. We'll put links to the show and to you on Twitter and so forth, so that our listeners can catch up with you. But until then, Gene, thank you very much for taking the time out for us.
It was an honor and privilege, Sir Peter. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks very much. I could have talked to Gene for hours there. I'm flabbergasted by the size and scope of the NASA program. Over 100 space programs they're actively delivering at the moment. But the one that really gets me, and you can get all the information on their website, which is fantastic, it's nasa.gov. The project of Voyager, 11 billion miles away, just amazing. And it's got that recorded message on it that the Secretary General of the United Nations recorded 30 years ago, that thing's been winging its way out to the edge of our system.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, an organization of 147 member states who represent almost all of the human inhabitants of the planet Earth, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking only peace and friendship, to teach if we are called upon, to be taught if we are fortunate. We know full well that our planet and all its inhabitants are but a small part of this immense universe that surrounds us, and it is with humility and hope that we take this step.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I found interesting from Gene, his comments on the last shuttle launch, he sort of a big media event, and he was sort of saying, where were you guys?
Yeah,
you know, he couldn't move for media.
Yeah,
and he was, where were you guys before? You know, you should be supporting the kind of previous missions in a way. And again, that sort of has echoes of Apollo, because Apollo, you know, 13, you know, if you watch the film, you know, it's amazing. But you know, Apollo 11, all right, first landing, Apollo 12, Apollo 13. Apollo 13, you know, the people start to lose interest, or at least the media starts to kind of lose interest and say, well, yeah, you know, oh, they're going to the moon again.
Yeah.
Great. So there is a question there. Is space flight isn't routine. It's still rocket science. It's still very, very difficult. You're still on the real edge of possibility. So how do you keep that experience fresh? How do you keep people interested? The great thing at the moment with Commander of the ISS at the moment, Commander Hadfield there, who's tweeting out left, right and centre.
Yeah.
You know, great pictures, great observations. He had even had a little sort of Twitter conversation going with William Shatner. But, you know, getting that sort of like, wow, you know, here's a guy who's tweeting from space. That sort of thing, I think, is just brilliant.
So the battery on his iPhone must be a lot better than mine. I know that much. I think, Peter, that number, that distance away. I mean, it's almost almost incomprehensible, isn't it? You cannot really get your head round a number like that. And I think it does really, really grab you. And I have to say, for me, my interest, you know, we'll see with the Andrew interview, has always been back at the start, the space race, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo. And what's gone in between, you know, I'm not knocking the shuttle project, you know, triumph and tragedy, etc. But now I feel myself being really drawn back into it all again, because we're going, all right, not with men, but we're going so far. We're going so far, and you cannot help but get caught up in numbers like that. You just sit down and think, I'll try and get my head around that. Actually, no, I can't get my head around that. That's impossible.
I agree. And just doing the research for this show and reading some of the material, as I said, on NASA.gov, on some of the projects they're running, and some of the free material that's readily available to download on the Hubble Space Telescope and some of the things that they're discovering there, it's just really invigorated my interest. And as you say, there's so much going on. 100 programs, you know. I think, you know, Tim mentioned Surrey Satellites. They've got 22 satellites in progress at the moment to be launched, and they're building them down in Guildford in the UK. I mean, it really is amazing times. And Gareth, you got to speak to the author of Moondust, an absolutely brilliant book by Andrew Smith.
Yeah, Peter, this was a real, real treat for me. And, you know, as I've already said, you know, this is the period which grabbed me, the space race, the quest to not just get up there, but then to Kennedy's, you know, we're going to put a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth by the end of the decade, which, of course, was the 1960s. And Andrew's book, I'm not going to spoil the interview, but where he essentially set out to find the nine remaining, the nine guys that are still alive who walked on the moon. It's an absolutely brilliant book. It's fabulous. And to talk to him, absolute pleasure. Very, very grateful. Andrew Smith, welcome to Extended. Thank you for your time.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, look, just for anybody who hasn't read Moondust, and it is an incredible piece of work for it, I think, for anybody who's interested in that remarkable period of time. Just tell us a little bit about it. What's the premise behind the whole thing?
Well, basically, I was a kid in California when the first moon landing happened, and I remember vividly, you know, just how important it seemed. It seemed like the world changed that day, and we were, you know, humanity was going to be going tearing off in a completely new and exciting direction. And then, of course, it came to an end very abruptly in about 72, the Apollo program. So we weren't going to the moon anymore. No one's been out of Earth orbit since. And like most people, I'd pretty much forgotten about it, stopped thinking about it, moved on to other stuff. We're still a kid, you know, when it stopped.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until 1999, I was working as a feature writer at the Observer newspaper in London, and there was a bit at the back of the paper, this kind of of the magazine, that this sort of Q&A thing where you just sit down with someone and ask them, and it would be written up in Q&A form.
Sure.
I didn't like doing it. Most of us, it was kind of boring for a writer. And they eventually cornered me and said, look, Andrew, it's your turn. You've got to do one of these. And I said, all right, then. And I just sort of had a look at who was around at the time who I might be interested in doing that with, who might be interesting to meet. And it turned out that Charlie Duke was in London with his wife, Dottie. Now, he was the on the second-to-last mission, which was quite a joyous mission. The two guys, he and John Young, were good friends and really, really loved each other. And Charlie had come back, though, and he'd had a hard time when he got back, sort of into reintegrating into everyday life, and just hadn't found anything that satisfied him. He'd had alcohol problems. He'd become quite a brutal parent, and his marriage was on the rocks. And his wife, Dottie, who's a formidable woman, eventually sort of pulled them back together through through faith, through religion.
Yep.
And they got back together and were happy and everyone thriving. And they had founded a mission, and they were in London to talk about their missionary work. So I went and sat down with them one morning and had a, you know, really fascinating time. And it was a good opportunity for me to think a little bit about that time again, which I really hadn't. And it turned out that the day before, one of the other moonwalkers, the third man on the moon, Pete Conrad, he was the commander of the mission. He'd had a motorbike accident. He was expected to be fine afterwards. But unfortunately, while I was with Charlie and Dottie, word came through that, in fact, Pete had died. And they were really upset about it because everyone loved this guy, Pete Conrad. Who's supposed to reckon to be the source, Tom Wolfe's major source for the Right Stuff, actually.
Yes.
And as I was getting up to go, I stayed chatting with him for a while about that. And as I was getting up to go, Charlie just said, now there's only 9 of us. And I thought, wow, there were only ever 12. And now there's 9. And I found myself going away thinking, well, that means that one day, you know, in the nearish future, there won't be anyone on Earth who stood on the moon. And this sort of haunted me for a couple of years, actually. And it was really at that point that someone said to me, look, you're still talking about this.
Go do something about it.
I wonder what happened to all these guys, because hardly anyone knew who they were. And they'd sort of disappeared. And I knew that some of them had problems when they came back. So I just thought, well, I'm going to go and find them all. So I just set out to go and find them.
It is a remarkable story, and I remember saying when I blogged about Moondust that one of the things that struck me, and I've got like a library of books here, is that the refreshing thing was that you clearly didn't want to pursue the angles that other the approach that other pieces of work had taken. I mean, you sort of dig a bit deeper and come at it from a different place, don't you?
Well, in many ways, the Moondust you know, the shorthand for what's it about, when people say what's it about, the easiest thing for me to say is, well, it's about the guys who walked on the moon, right? But it's not really. It's about us watching the guys walk on the moon,
yeah.
What it meant to us and what it meant to them afterwards in many ways. It's sort of about what that did to us, what it meant to us. And I was more interested in that. The nuts and bolts is brilliantly dealt with elsewhere. I mean, Andy Chagin's book, Command on the Moon.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrific book, and I would never have been able to write something better than that anyway. And it's not really my bent. It's not the way I look at things. I tend to see big pictures rather than getting in on the details. So it was a natural.
Now, before we talk about the men, I was born 3 weeks after the end of Apollo 17. So this isn't, this is not a period that unfortunately, to my eternal regret, that I was there to experience. And you were clearly only a youngster. I'm not trying to make out that you're ancient or anything, but just put this period, this sort of Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, space race against the Soviets, the Cold War. What sort of context was this in? I mean, politically it was a huge thing, but culturally as well, wasn't it?
Well, it's fascinating that, and the origins of the program itself are the most extraordinary thing. Because basically what happened in 1957, human beings hadn't been into space, hadn't sent anything to space. The Russians suddenly sent up the Sputnik satellite. And this caused panic in America because no one knew what they were going to do with it. And there were these talks. Orbiting bomb and all the rest of it, which were absolute bunkum. There's no advantage to putting a bomb in space to hang around, in fact, or a missile. But there was panic, and it was felt that American technology was way behind the Soviet Union, and people were scared. It was the height of the Cold War. You know, kids were being taught to duck and cover, jump under their desks at school, air raid sirens. I was in New York, not in 57. I wasn't born yet, but my mum said, they tested the air raid sirens every week. You know, it was really seriously tense time.
Yeah.
And America had a space program, and what they did was ramp up science. They poured money into science and technology, and they were genuinely behind the Soviets, who then went and sent the first human being into space, Yuri Gagarin, ahead of the Americans. And Kennedy came in. end of 1960, he was elected, took office in early 61, and was looking at all this and saw the sort of demoralization there was in American science and technology. And he met with the NASA people, and they told him what their plans were, which was, you know, just to get people up in space, sure, and go around orbit, maybe head for the moon sometime in the 1980s, maybe.
Right.
And Kennedy said, well, what about going to the moon now? And they went, you know, well, harder than what we're doing now. It's an order of magnitude different. And Kennedy wouldn't let go, apparently. And then one day, the head of NASA got a phone call saying, you might want to watch JFK's speech on the... All right. And Kennedy said, we're going to put a man on the moon, bring him back by the end of the decade. And the story is that the head of NASA in Houston woke up screaming that night because he had no idea. Any of the things they needed, the technology wasn't invented. They had to invent everything from scratch. And for that period, what Kennedy knew was, you know, his scientists all said, you don't need to send people. Don't send people. We'll send robots. And we can do it much cheaper. It'll be safer, obviously. And we'll do the same science. And Kennedy just wanted to send people. And what he understood was that that would really capture the public's imagination, who, you know, who'd been raised on space films and all the B movies in the 1950s. And for that decade, and it may be the only one, that taxpayer sort of said, yeah, we'll do this. And it cost $24 billion, a lot of money. And I don't know, there was opposition to it for sure, but surprisingly little, particularly on the part of senators and congressmen. So he got away with it, and they did it. And NASA had to set out and do this thing.
I mean, there is a, you know, we could probably talk all day, Andrew, that, you know, the backstory to all of this with sort of Wernher von Braun, you know, Nazis essentially producing the rockets which sent Americans to the moon and such like. But the nuts and bolts have been, as you say, have been discussed brilliantly elsewhere. But just in terms of technological advance, as you've just intimated, they were starting almost from scratch, weren't they?
They were. It was amazing. And even when they got to the point of landing on the moon, they were using the first integrated circuitry computers. They were but even then, actually, the computer on the lunar module, which landed on the moon, had less power than far less than your mobile phone and probably less watch.
Absolutely incredible.
With what for us now is an incredibly primitive technology, and the systems they developed were just awesomely clever and brilliant. And a lot of people, you know, it's half a million people were involved in the effort in one way or another, they reckon. And it was a really huge team effort.
Now let's just talk for a minute about the men at the sharp end. These were guys that were pilots, mainly test pilots, military men or ex-military men, engineers. They really shaped how the whole program looked and felt, didn't they? Because they certainly weren't PR people, were they? And if it was something that was being done today, for example, I guess it would look and feel a lot different.
It's one of the first things I noticed when I met these guys, that how individual they were and how many, you know, mavericks there were amongst them, because they weren't chosen with PR in mind, whereas clearly that would be one of NASA's first thoughts now, you know, how would these to the public. No one cared. Any thought. What they were was nearly all very brilliant engineers and scientists, as well as brilliant pilots. There was one who wasn't a pilot, Jack Schmidt, on the last mission. They'd been scientists had got really angry with NASA for not sending a scientist, so they did send one.
Sure.
And but the rest of them were sort of these Renaissance men in many ways, with a whole range of skills, super clever. And they were involved in designing and making and testing all the systems too. They weren't passive in this in any way.
What's your sort of over when you look back now to your meetings with the astronauts that you met? What's your kind of overriding memory of those meetings? Yes, they're all very different and such like, but is it possible to sum up that group of people or not?
It's, yes, you know, and it was only when I got to Jack Schmidt, the scientist, sitting down in, I remember it really vividly because I was waiting for him in a hotel in Albuquerque where he lived. And I was just sitting sort of watching the door, and I saw him come in and saw him standing in the lobby sort of looking around to see if he could see me. It was quite a big hotel. And I didn't go straight to him and say hi. For a moment, I just sat there and thought, the bloke standing there in the middle of the lobby who stood on the moon, I haven't the faintest idea. A different take on a lot of these things because his background was different. He had to train as a pilot, and in fact, in his training class. But with I think Navy pilots. But he sat down and he said, well, you know, this is a very select group of the American population because they are all either first elder siblings or first sons in their families. And I went, that's extraordinary, really. And I went and checked, and they all were, every single one of them. So there's a sort of a straightforwardly human dimension there too. Yes, they yep. were, they are the type in that sense. They were all very driven, very kind of determined, very bright. But other than that, no, there's nothing you can say apart from the fact that they were also pretty much all, not completely all, but mostly unbelievably modest about what they'd done and self-effacing about it, and it, not inclined to take personal credit for it. In exactly the same way that Armstrong was. You know, Armstrong never believed that it was him. He thought it was a team effort, and he didn't deserve the individual credit for just doing his job.
Very military feel about it, didn't it? It was a mission, wasn't it?
For sure. And most, funny enough, Armstrong is one of the ones who wasn't a military pilot. He was a civilian pilot, NASA. But most of the others came from the military, which is where they got their flying skills, obviously. So, you know, one knock-on effect of that is that most of them never made any money because they were just, they carried on paid according to their rank, yep. the military, and didn't get rich from it at all. They didn't get any extra danger money or anything like that. And I remember Buzz Aldrin's wall, he actually showed me, he had his expenses claim form for his trip to the moon. And I swear to you, it said Cape Canaveral, moon, Pacific Ocean, $34.27. they surprised in almost every respect. They surprised me. But personality-wise, they were wildly different, really wildly different.
Let's just talk about Neil Armstrong, Andrew. You obviously didn't get that kind of sit-down face-to-face in Moondust that you undoubtedly would have loved to have done, but you then went on to produce a documentary for the BBC called Being Neil Armstrong, which took a sort of much deeper look just at him. But you did correspond with him, didn't you, and he sent you some fantastic emails and such like.
Yeah, he did, which are up on my website actually. If you go to author.com, we put, because I kept, people were constantly asking, you know, can we see a copy of the emails that Neil sent, the full text, and so I put them up on the website, so they're there for anyone who wants to have a look at them. And his personality really comes through in them, because he's surprisingly, he didn't like doing interviews and sort of didn't do them after the moon flight. He didn't think it was the best way for him to communicate his thoughts and ideas, and so didn't. But he did say, and he wouldn't give opinion on stuff until towards the end of his life. He did start a little bit, but he previously wouldn't. And I think that was partly because he didn't want his status to be exploited to sort of amplify whatever opinions he had. So again, it's a reflection of his modesty, I think. But he would answer questions of fact, and he did offer to respond to emails and things like that, questions I had. And in fact, one of my favorite bits of information came from one of his emails when they were each allowed to take a cassette tape of music with them. And Collins, who was the command module pilot on Apollo 11, meaning the one who stayed in orbit around the moon, didn't drop to the surface. He described Neil as taking, I think he took New World Symphony, but then also some what Collins called strange electronic sounding music. And and so I asked Neil, and he wrote back saying it was an album of theremin music. And who doesn't know what theremin is? It's that strange whaley sound that you hear on 1950s B movie soundtrack. And on Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys, that sound that goes woo. Yeah, he took an Elvis to the moon with him, which he recorded in his own collection. And I just love that. Who else but Neil Armstrong would take theremin music to the moon?
I don't know about you, but when Neil passed in August of last year, here's somebody that just from a personal thing, from my level, I've read lots and lots about and have taken a great interest in. But I almost felt surprised that there was such a massive outpouring. I shouldn't have been surprised. He was the first man on the moon, but this just seemed as if this was something that almost had been taken for granted or pushed to one side, and then suddenly came blindingly back into focus.
I think so, and I wonder if that things in that way anymore. So him losing him, it obviously had a greater significance than just losing one man. And I think so. There was a sense that something went with him, which we may have lost, or it was misplaced for a while. You know. I was not surprised by it. I mean, one of the funny things about Moondust is that one of my spurs for wanting to write it, and I started in 2002. I set out to find the astronauts. And the thing that made them interesting to me then was the fact that no one was talking about them. They'd all been forgotten. Hardly anyone could name any of them. And the 30th anniversary of the first moon landing passed by almost unnoticed.
Yeah. A
couple of short items on the news, that was it. You know, came and went. And I thought, this is really odd, because the further we get from that period, those 3 years that we were landing on the moon, the stranger they look and the more fascinating they look. And I think by this time we've caught up with that in a way. I think people have realized what an extraordinary odd thing to do that was, and what a massive act of invention. So, yeah, I think there was a lot. And strangely, I think this was almost more kind of ardent in the UK than in the US, is my...
It's interesting, isn't it? That is interesting.
And they say, yes, that could be true.
Listen, hindsight's a wonderful thing, and obviously we can't turn the clock back. There are a couple of characters, one of whom you've already mentioned, who I'm sure, like me, you would have loved the opportunity to interview. And I think, you know, Pete Conrad is definitely one. And for me anyway, and I'd be interested to see if you agree, Alan Shepard, who was obviously there right from the start of Mercury Project, is the other. Is that something that's crossed your mind? You know, God, I would have loved to have chatted to Conrad and Shepard.
Conrad, for me, fun. I mean, he was rejected for the first wave of astronauts that became the Mercury 7. And the reason that's given, one of the reasons it's given, is that he was just so irreverent in his approach to all the tests that they did. One of the things they had to do was sit at a table with a psychiatrist who would hold up a blank sheet of paper and say, "What do you see?" Brad's response was to sit back in his chair, look at it carefully, it's upside down. That led to them going, "Oh, this guy don't have it." And as I say, he's thought to be the main source for Tom. And the whole kind of cadre of astronauts just loved him. They adored him. Neil Armstrong called him the best man I ever knew, which is quite something.
Wow. That's a lot of those stories, as you say, are told in the right stuff. The fact that Moondust has been mentioned in the same sentence, that must be something that you're quite proud of, I should imagine.
Yeah, that is really. There's a few things like that. There was Sunday Times who said that, actually. And there's that, and David Bowie getting word to me that he loved the book was possibly my proudest moment ever, being music. Clark as well. I've got a letter for Clark. So that was, you know, that was those little things really are lovely when that happens, because you can't legislate for them. You don't know it's going to happen.
No. Just getting towards the end, Andrew. Since the Apollo project came to an end, you know, we've had sort of Skylab, the sort of triumph and tragedy of the space shuttle project. You know, we now have the International Space Station and such like. But man has not gone out of Earth orbit. Is it ever going to happen again? Why hasn't it happened? I mean, that's quite a big question. But really, we've not progressed in that sense, have we?
No, I mean, it's in some ways, I think the answer is brutally simple to that. The Apollo project coincided with the greatest period of economic expansion the world's ever seen, and that was unlike now. It was spread much more evenly, so people did feel that they could afford, you know, we could afford as a society to be sending people into space. Very expensive to send people into space, because when you send people, you have to send all the things that to sustain them. And those things are heavy. So straightforwardly, there was a kind of driving factor in the Cold War. And some of Kennedy's advisors have since explicitly said that we saw the space program and the lunar project as a way of sublimating a third world war. We could keep up the military economy and the missile economy without endangering, you know, the whole rest of the planet. We could turn it into a race to the moon, and it would keep everyone safe and actually be fantastic entertainment and really interesting. So there were those two factors. There was the Cold War, and there was the fact that there was the money for it. Come 1972, the world hit a big recession, very similar to now. And of course, it was felt that we didn't want to spend that money sending people up into space at that point. Also, you know, Charlie Duke has said, if we'd got up there and stepped onto the moon and found some little green men looking back at us, then kept going. I'm absolutely sure we will do it. And I'm sure we'll send people to Mars at some point, which is, again, a much bigger thing and much more difficult. I think it's going to need the various countries to find a way to work together to do it, because if you combined all the different national space programs, you could do quite a lot with the money that goes into that. Whereas when separated, then it's the money is dissipated and you can't focus on the big things in quite the same way. I mean, I've been very, very heartened by the interest there's been in the Mars rovers,
sure,
which really caught people's imaginations. And I think they're wonderful things, because again, they're just such brilliant bits of technology and so exciting to be able to see images coming back from Mars in, you know, but more or less real time in cosmic terms.
Yeah.
And that bodes well, I think. I think that's really done something good as far as, you know, awareness goes. One day we'll be sending people back up there, I'm sure.
Well, I hope so. I think it's almost feels like something that every generation should be able to experience. Finally, you mentioned obviously the meeting with Charlie Duke was almost by chance, but you then, you know, you got almost bitten by that little bug that led you to moon dust. What was it, a cathartic experience, or have you stayed bitten, as it were? Is it something that you think will always occupy an important part of your life now?
Well, I'll always be interested in it. It was cathartic for me, because it was, in many ways, it was also going back to that time. For me personally, it marks a change in my life, because my family moved back. My parents are both British. I grew up in the States, in New York and California, and we moved back to the UK in 74. So it was the end of the space program really marks also the end of my time in America as a kid. And so for me, it was cathartic doing that and going back and trying to work out why I was so kind of saddened by the idea that one day there wouldn't be anyone on Earth who had stood on the moon. And some of that is for like kind of lost childhood, lost memory, to nostalgia for another time, for the kind of innocence that there was then. Because one of the other things that characterized that period was people's feeling that there were all kinds of terrible things happening, like the Vietnam War. But there was a real sense that things would get better, that the trajectory we're on was that things would get better. And what really changed in the 70s was that no longer existed. David Bowie caught that really well in Ziggy Stardust and all those his 70s music and records, that, as he says, everything was up for grabs all of a sudden. You didn't really know how things were going, what trajectory were on, and there was suddenly room to believe that things were just going to get it worse. So looking at that time was really interesting, and I have to say, by the end of it, I didn't really want to leave it. I would have I had to really pull myself back out of the 60s. And I still have a real affection for 60s psychedelic music.
that clearly will never leave you. Well, look, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for talking to Extend, Andrew. It is a wonderful piece of work. Thank you for writing it. And yeah, it's really, really good to hear from you. We'll make sure, you know, on the notes that go out in this podcast, that, you know, if people haven't read it, we know where they can go and get it, because it is a fantastic read. It's one of those sort of classic pick it up, can't put it down books. So thank you once again. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a total pleasure. Thanks very much. I enjoyed that.
Thanks, Andrew.
Gosh, we can all remember the first men on the moon, but it really sticks in my mind, having read the book, how poorly they were paid and handled afterwards by the whole media and system there. And $8 a day for flying in space.
Yeah, I mean, as Andrew said, you know, they were essentially paid according to their, you know, to their military rank. There was no danger money, as he said. There was nothing extra. It was considered to be sort of like a volunteer dangerous duty, that essentially if any of them at any point didn't want to go ahead with, they would go back to doing whatever they were doing before, you know. And it was that kind of, there'll be no mark on your records if you decide not to do this. But it was, as I said to Andrew, they treated it very, very much as a mission. You know, it was a very military styled program, and the reason for that, of course, is because they were in a race.
Yeah.
And the political significance of this, you know, with American politicians saying, you know, I for one do not want to go to sleep under the light of a Soviet moon, you know, that is the level that it was on. You know, the Cold War was at its height, and Andrew mentioned it brilliantly, this whole theory that the Russians were going to get up there and put, and there'd be bombs raining down from space onto the United States and everything. I mean, it's just, unless you live through it, I think it's very difficult to absolutely get your head around that. But Moondust does a brilliant job of putting you there, because of the way that Andrew approaches it. As he said, it's not about the technical minutiae, and there are some fantastic books that cover that off. It's a very human side of the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things that, you know, he mentions there, and it comes out in his book as well, is as an alternative to having a full-scale nuclear war, trying to best the other guy by having a race to the moon. Great.
And of course, I would just like to mention, if I may, just quickly, obviously Neil Armstrong, who the world lost last August. I mean, that's the incredible thing, is that there were 9 surviving moonwalkers when Andrew set out to write his book, which was, you know, sort of 10 years ago or so now, and actually Neil Armstrong was the first one of those to pass away. So let's hope the others will live forever. That's what I think.
3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
Here, we got a roll program.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Okay, we've still got lots to get through, but here's our new segment,
Things you never knew about.
In this segment, we want to bring you something into the show that's new and we can learn from. This comes from our last episode where Tim mentioned one of the best things anyone can do is to keep learning the subject. And it got us thinking. So we're going to start with this episode with a subject. But if you've got an aviation or aerospace first that you think is something no one will ever know or we can all learn from, then record us a brief segment telling us what it is. Remember, it's got to be something we can learn from, or at least the majority of us anyway. So, being a space-focused episode, we thought we'd bring you some space-related things you never knew about. When researching the programme, I came across a bit of information that I always wondered, but never really knew. And that's how do astronauts go to the toilet, and what happens next? Now, spacecraft toilets have to get rid of the waste in low gravity conditions, which of course could be a bit of a challenge. Astronauts have to sit on a device which sucks away the waste. Solid waste is dried and dumped into space, but the water is saved. I also learned that on the International Space Station, the Americans and the Russians have separate toilets in their own modules, and that neither is allowed to use the others unless specific permission has been granted from the respective space bodies back on the ground. Now, I'm led to believe it's one of those unwritten rules that this never ever happens. And, of course, as Gene mentioned earlier, some waste is put back into the capsules sent back to burn in the atmosphere. So there you go.
Things you never knew about.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation.
And so to the Get Involved section of the show.
Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, two competitions from our last episode. Gareth, we had 5 Typhoon posters signed by Flight Lieutenant Jamie Norris. Can you remind us of the question and give us the correct answer, please?
Absolutely. The question was that Jamie is an instructor on 29 Reserve Squadron, which is the Typhoon OCU. And the question was, what does OCU stand for? And it does, of course, stand for Operational Conversion Unit.
Okay, and the correct answers we pulled from the hat are John Copeland, Ian Kershaw, Amy Parkin, David Smith, and Paul Frost. And Tim, to our second competition, the question was...
The question there was, what are the names of the 3 V bombers? And the answer, obviously, to win a copy of Vulcan 607 was the Vulcan, the Victor, and the Valiant.
And our winner there, selected at random, was Christopher Davis from Auckland in New Zealand. So I think that probably does prove that it was randomly selected.
Yeah, and Christopher, if you're listening, your book's here whenever you want to come and pick it up.
Now, we have Chris's address, but not the others. So please email us back with your contact details and those prizes will be winging their way out to you. Over to some regular feedback from Mark Harvey. Mark wrote to us, thanks for a great podcast. I've caught up on them all and really enjoying them. Listen to them in the car on my way to and from work. It makes the journey a lot more enjoyable. Thanks very much, Mark. He goes on to say he had a look back at his images from the Friday arrivals at Yeovilton in 2012, and he got Gareth arriving in the Jet Provost with Neil McCarthy, which he sent along to us, and we're going to put them on our Facebook page. Very, very nice sharp photography there, Mark. But he also asks a question. He's got his own gallery, photography.newquay-plus.co.uk, and he's got some images from Yeovilton and the Shoreham Air Show. But what he wants is a bit of feedback and a bit of advice on any comments the team might have about the best way to get into aviation photography.
Well, I don't claim to be an expert, but I would say that going to things like Yeovilton, the air show circuit offers you brilliant opportunities. Firstly, I must just say as well, thank you very much for the pictures. We came in sort of just after and just before quite a hefty rain shower on that Friday, so I don't have loads of pictures of us from the ground, so thank you very much. But keep going to the air shows. You know, it gives you a great opportunity to take pictures of the aircraft on the ground as well as in the air. And also, you get it's great for practice because you, depending on where you go, obviously, but you might get to shoot, you know, helicopters, fast jets, warbirds, possibly even some larger aircraft, display teams, and such like. So, I mean, that's kind of where I started taking pictures. And also, depending on where you are, get out to your local airport if you can bear it. And then there's somewhere to go to sit on the fence. And, you know, it is really just a practice thing. It's a bit like playing golf, I always think. You know, you can never really master it. You have good days and you have bad days. But the more you do, your good days increase. So and you know, if you're on Twitter and such like, post your pictures on there. People get great feedback on there, on their pictures and sort of do's and don'ts and such like.
And on Twitter we got some messages from S. Powney, who is at QSY en route. We also got the same message from Martin Needham and also from City Airport, and they let us know that City Airport having a airport and heliport photography day on the 17th of March. Now, City Airport, to most of us who know it, is more familiarly known as Barton. And apparently the photography day includes airside access and access to the control tower. So if you're interested on that, get over to cityairportandheliport.com and get the details from that. We'll put a link in the show notes. We also want to thank Chris Globe because we posted one of Chris's pictures on our Facebook page celebrating the birthday of the MD-11. So thanks very much, Chris.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Main engine start, 0.
And finally, before we go, Gareth, what topic would you like to promote?
Well, I'm going to give Andrew Smith another mention, I'm afraid. If you haven't read Moondust and you're at all interested in that subject, go and get it. You can find it on Amazon. But equally, go to andrewsmithauthor.com, click on the Moondust section. There's some really nice information on there. It's got some of his emails from Neil Armstrong. And also there's a couple of video interviews with Andrew as well, where you can learn a bit more. So, yeah, go and have a look. It's good stuff.
And Tim, have you got an aerospace topic you want to promote?
Okay, well, we've got some interesting lectures coming up to the Society. We always have interesting lectures, but there's three really cool ones to get to the Society. 7th of February, we've got astronaut Tim Peake coming to speak at the Society in London. We've then got on 11th of Feb, we've got a history of British unmanned aircraft, 1917 to present. So if you are into UAVs, drones, that's something to look out for. And particularly on 14th of March, we've got, and this is, I have never seen a lecture like this before, is Airbus and Boeing test pilots jointly doing a lecture on jet transport stalls. So flight testing from the two big rivals, that's going to be ace.
When's that one again, Tim?
That's 40th of March,
ooh,
London.
That might be one I might have to get along to, actually.
Is that going to be like a presidential debate? sort of head-to-head?
Well, it says it's jointly presenting this lecture. It's going to deal with stall requirements, predictive validation, and flight testing. They will address areas where the two approaches share common ground, as well as exploring areas where they differ on technical approaches. So that's going to be. I can't wait for that one.
Yeah, that really sounds exciting. For me, this episode's really unearthed some great resources on the internet. I've mentioned NASA.gov, but of course you must go and visit our very own European Space Agency at ESA.int, as well as, of course, the UK Space Agency. And there's one site and program you might want to investigate. It's called Amiga Tau, and it's a science and engineering podcast, but one that's got some great aviation episodes on it, such as flying the U-2 and flying the SR-71 Blackbird. but there's some absolutely brilliant space episodes on there. And like me, if you've ever wondered how NASA landed men on the moon and how they did it, there are two episodes on there which frankly rank in my favourite programmes of all time. Presenter Marcus Volta talks to British author David Woods about his book, which is titled How Apollo Flew to the Moon. And he really gives a fascinating insight into how they did it. David really explains the technology in easily understood language. You can hear that at OmegaTaoPodcast.com and look for the English episodes. Now, we'd also like to put out another supporting message for the National Aerospace Library. It's one of the world's most extensive libraries, and it's devoted to the development of aeronautics, aviation and aerospace technology. The library has a comprehensive selection of over 20,000 books and many, many more items. So please visit them through their website or do go down there in person. It's absolutely free. I think every aerospace or aviation enthusiast will find something to their taste. And finally, on promoting aerospace, please promote us by leaving us iTunes feedback. It's really important we keep the show well promoted and visible. So help us promote Extended, tell a friend, leave feedback on iTunes, and help spread the word at your work, your airfield, the pub, or an air show. Before we sign off on this episode, tell us if you like this subject, as we intend including aerospace topics in future episodes. Okay, it's time to wrap up for this episode. I'd like to thank Emma Lord, Gene McCulker, Tim Peake, and Andrew Smith for their time in contributing to what has been a absolutely fabulous show. Gareth, where can we find you online?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Gareth_Stringer, and everything Global Aviation Resource related is at globalaviationresource.com.
And Tim, where can we find you online?
RAS Tim R on Twitter. And you can find all the information about the Royal Aeronautical Society at www.aerosociety.com.
And you can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk, as well as facebook.com/xtpmedia. Show notes for this episode can be found at aviationextended.co.uk, and our Facebook page is facebook.com/aviationextended. I'd like to thank White Arts for the use of their music and Peter Dixon for our voiceovers. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Goodbye, everybody.
And it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye all, and see you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Thank you very much for joining us for episode 9. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Extended. And remember, stay tuned into this frequency, Extended, the ETOPS Aviation and Aerospace Program.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
It's never easy, is it?
Right, have we lost someone?
No. Nope.
Did you want us to lose someone? So far, yeah, so far no drippy water.
Okay. Okay.
There's always one.
Anyway, enough of that. I've tried all those cunning plans and they don't work.
This was purely ridiculously for my own amusement.
Extend it.
The final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship
Extended.
Its 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no
podcast
man has gone before.
Podcast.
I'm sure I can get that in somewhere. You were doing the not to labour a point.
Not to labour a point.
Yeah.
I laboured a point.
You were.
Please labour this point.
You have now. Come on, you're labouring the point, Tim.
Yeah. I think you were just about to labour the point. It's so long ago, I can't remember what I said. okay.
Emma, as I said, I didn't know that there was a UK space industry. Oh, God, my mind's gone blank. What's the question I was going to ask you then? Oh, yeah.
And right. At 5 o'clock this morning, I f***ed over tit.
Oh, no.
And it's never more amazing than what's going on in terms of our closest planet, which, of course, is the moon.
Yeah, this was a...
Sorry, can I correct you there? Closest celestial body rather than planet.
Okay.
You'll get loads of people writing. We'll get loads of people writing in now. Emailing in. Angry.
We've only got four listeners, and one of them's my mum. So,
spot the deliberate mistake.
Most of celestial body is probably safe for the planet.
Okay. Point taken.
Ready for me?
Yeah.
I've suddenly got this vision of an important phone call being made on the kind of the hotline between Washington and Moscow, you know, of the president kind of ringing up and sort of saying, you know, one of our astronauts is a bit, you know, can I use your toilet? You know, we've got a blockage in ours and you know, or somebody's in there, you know, reading a comic or something, I don't know. You know, can we come out on your end and use your toilet, you know?
Tim, you with us?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Did anyone hear my dog sneezing then?
No.
Nope.
Okay, we're done then.
Probably would have laughed if I had done.
The ETOPS Aviation Podcast, until, of course, the FAA ground us and remove our ETOPS qualification. Then we can only do 20 minutes, you know.
This is XTP Media.